You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there. Well, hello and welcome to a very special crossover episode between the 602 Club and Aggressive Negotiations. So these will be coming at you live on the TFM network as well as the Nerd Party network. And with me in this first crossover, we can't believe we haven't done it before, Jedi Master John Mills.
I could have sworn that we had, but at the same time, the 602 Club was the birthplace of Aggressive Negotiations, quite literally.
It's true.
You know, it just feels like since they are their cousins, basically, that we did. But I guess not. So, cool. You know? All right.
It just feels right.
It does. It does.
So,
it's like that song, Being Reunited, and it feels so good. So
absolutely, absolutely. Well, of course, you can find the networks all over the place on social media, you know, at Trek FM or at Join Nerd Party on X Twitter. Of course, you can find both networks on Facebook, facebook.com/TheNerdParty or facebook.com/TrekFM. Of course, we're online at Trek FM as well as The Nerd Party. And of course, you can find a listeners only discussion group there called the Babel Conference for all the listeners there on TFM. You can join and all sorts of things like that. But John, the reason that we are doing this incredible crossover episode for everyone is because, the final season of The Bad Batch has happened, and we have now seen the completion of this part of the story. And, of course, you know, we don't know what's going to come next, but my goodness, we'll get into it. We've got so much to talk about this season, but I wanted to ask you because... So this is something that with the animated series, it seems like they're doing more of, which is kind of allowing multiple episodes to air at one time. And especially with the beginning. In fact, they also did the same thing for Andor, right? You had three episodes drop at the beginning of that show. And so it's not just animation. So with season three, we had a massive opening of three episodes. And so much happens in those three episodes, way more than I even could have imagined was going to happen, especially since you end up having Crosshair and Omega, you know, escape from Tantus. You have, you know, meeting a new character like Batcher. You know, we meet some... clone cadets, you know, on the mission that Hunter and Wrecker are on. And so it's just, I got to ask you, what did you think of opening the season this way?
Oh, it was definitely, it was great, simply because it was all so good. But also, it's a frustrating thing is that we're all still trying to find the balance between what's been, you know, affectionately referred to as binge watching and this weekly release schedule. The weekly release schedule can be frustrating at times because you want more and you're forced to wait. And that's the way it used to always be, kids and blah, blah, anything else that those of us who remember broadcast TV being the only option could throw out there to everybody. But at the same time, you know, it's interesting because I think that it speaks to an idea that floats around in my brain every so often, that our collective fixation on formats being like between, there's almost this binary brain freeze between us between 30 and 60 minutes for any episode of any show. And that's still tied to old broadcast mentality. And it's like, I would love them to give the creators the freedom to say, you know what? It's X amount of hours of runtime. And do, you know, if you want to have like a 2-hour TV movie in the middle of the season, and then, I mean, look at me falling into the half hour, hour category again. But like, if you want to throw something in there and, you know, have episodes be wildly varying in length, that would be an experiment worth seeing. All of that to say, I was really grateful for the 3 episodes that were dropped at once, because this would have been a very difficult arc to be patient for, to see where it was going, especially because I think that the very first opening notes of the first episode of the season were so incredibly well done to show the way that Omega was back in a life we had seen her in at the beginning of the first season. She was back to life as it was in a research facility with a Kaminoan guiding her around with a bunch of clones. But we saw it demonstrated how different things were just in the short span of time between Kamino and the Empire having control of the program. And that I thought was just an absolutely brilliant way to kick it all off.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that, like you said, the juxtaposition of this season versus especially the first season when we first meet Omega and what her life is like, you know, you see the massive difference between, you know, Kamino under the Republic, you know, where they have freedom to do what they want, you know, there's freedom on the planet. And here, this complete imperial control hovering over everything and threatening everybody. I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, there's a complete difference in Nala Se, you know, who is destroying Omega's samples because she tells Omega that it's going to be dangerous for her if they find out what Nala Se knows about Omega. And we're going to find out throughout the season about Omega. And so, I mean, there's that. I mean, gosh, you even have one of the creepiest, scariest things happen, which is the Emperor visiting Tantus, which is, of course, the third episode of the season where they escape. Crosshair and Omega are able to escape. But and something that we've talked a lot about as we were walking through season 2 on aggressive negotiations was the idea of the way that Omega's character is continually growing throughout the seasons. And even in this first episode, I thought it was incredibly interesting to watch her as a character display these character traits that we know and love about her, but that are going to play throughout the entire rest of the season and that are going to be driving her as a character, right? You know, it's her loyalty, her ability to sympathize, even with people who might be seen as an enemy, you know, and this comes specifically with that relationship with Batcher. You know, it also comes in her relationship with Emery, right? The seeds are planted there for Emery's change. And all of that is done within these first 3 seasons, or all of that is done within these first 3 episodes. And then on top of that, you have that sandwich episode where you see just the insanity of the Advanced Science Division and what they've been up to. And basically, they've created their own version of Jurassic Park run amok with the Slither Vines. And like, it just the almost the depravity that you see of that that science division, who has it's completely amoral. We're just going to try and do things to see if we can do things and if we can use it to our advantage. And then, of course, you tie that in with the Emperor visiting, and it's just absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, the episode where you have the Slither Vines are truly an invention worthy of Star Wars, where this is that very classic, oh, yeah, that makes sense that a creature like that would be something I would encounter. Pre-1977, I don't think anybody really thought up a Dianoga. but it has that very 1950s science gone wrong vibe to it, where that's what's really enjoyable about it, is it has that mad scientist flair. And I think also speaks to something they have always had the decency to have as a running thread in Star Wars without being sloppy and blunt about it, which is the Empire subjugates people and it destroys nature. It destroys the beauty of anywhere. This is a beautiful, verdant planet. The Empire shows up and turns it into Monster World and then just leaves. It's like, it's broken. That's fine. We'll leave it there. And now for all time, anybody that happens to be, oh, hey, here's a planet I'm going to go check out, they're going to get eaten by Slithervines. Like, it's such a toss-off sort of thing where it's like, how would you even fix something like that? And, you know, because I love to crack jokes, you almost think the Death Star did serve a utilitarian purpose where, you know, there were planets like with Slithervines on them and the Emperor was like, you know, it's really actually the only way to take care of this. So, you know, we'll destroy the rebellion, then we got to go around and wipe up our old projects.
One of the things, of course, as well, that we've talked about many times on Aggressive Negotiations, and of course here is we've talked about Star Wars, which is, you know, this idea of the way in which especially the animation has always utilized the different genres and different movies and stories that we've seen in different films and everything, and kind of playing with those ideas. And there's just so much of the beauty of like the Jurassic Park type of motif in that, you know, it's like they took these vines and crossed it with a sarlacc to create this, you know, hideous monster, right, that you can't then control, that you thought you can control. And so, yeah, I mean, like, I think there's just something so beautiful about that. And then, of course, you know, with this big opening too, we all know as fans, even though the characters don't know, you know, we realize the Emperor is visiting Tantus to understand where these experiments are going, needing M count. And of course, we all know what that means. In fact, not only do we know what that means, but we actually see the testing that's happening, right? And it's the exact same test that you saw happening in episode one. It's the exact same look of the test on the screen as the what we saw in episode one. And so we get a better sense then of where this entire season is going to go, which is, okay, there's all these clones at Tantus, but we've also got exactly what they're looking for, which is, you know, of course, the connection all the way through to the sequel trilogy.
But also throwing in there, again, without being clumsy or sloppy or blunt about it, answering the question of, well, why don't you just create clone Jedi? And everybody's always had their sort of theories about it, and we'll all hold on to our theories, but here it is, basically answered. It's like, yeah, the midichlorians don't like that. So it's like, oh, well, yeah, okay, that's a fair point. Like, it's... The one thing I struggle with, actually, that I want to throw at you is they keep referring to M count because nobody would know what a midichlorian was outside of the Jedi, right? Do you think they did a good enough job for tying it together to midichlorian? Because we hear the word midichlorian once, I think. Do you think they do a good enough job of laying out what M count means, what it truly means to the characters and to the storyline? I'm not going to bias you giving you my own answer, but I'm curious, like, do you think there was, because there were people that complained about it, do you think that there was enough of a dot between A and B, you know, a line between point A and point B?
It's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it, because I think that if there's one thing that the season doesn't do well enough, is that. I think it should have just come out and said it. And I think that there should have been even greater connections made, in the sense of just stop beating around the bush about it and just say it outright. You know, what exactly, because at this point, you know, when the Emperor and Hemlock are talking, they're not going to be talking in code. They're talking together in a secure location about this project and a place that nobody in the galaxy can find at this moment. And so I also was a little bit perturbed that we actually never saw what was in the pods in that room. I felt like there just didn't seem to be a reason to hide that. Now, I'm sure that in some way we probably got maybe something else where we're going to get more information, but it just seemed as though like they were holding back, and I couldn't quite understand exactly why they were holding back. And because, you know, again, we mentioned, right, this connects with Project Necromancer. We've already heard about Project Necromancer in The Mandalorian. We know that that was what they were working on with Baby Yoda, right? And that you had, Moff Gideon trying to do the same thing that the Emperor had been doing. But we also saw that scene where Brendel Hux has been working on this idea, right? You know, so there's this connection, this thread running through. And, you know, I thought it was fascinating. But I also felt like, and I got to ask you this question in reference to Project Necromancer, I just felt like them beating around the bush about Omega's M count was something that was slightly frustrating for me as well, because obviously they allude to the fact that she does have a relatively high, she has to have a very special M count for this to work, for her to be so special.
I like that is not stated outright, because of the fact that it leaves in question about what that means for her future, because either she was genetically manipulated in such a way that it makes it possible for her cells to accept somebody else's midichlorians, which, you know, maybe that ties into. In terms of the M count thing, I think that, yes, it would have made more sense for the Emperor and Hemlock to have said it more outright. I don't mind not seeing what's in the pods, but that, you know, one of my favorite films is Pulp Fiction. What's in the briefcase doesn't matter. It's tied to why everybody's running around right now. And I like the idea of leaving it open. The name Necromancer, knowing they're messing with midichlorians. What I would hope they will do, whether it's in a book or another series, is show us at some point, maybe in Tales of the Empire season 2. Free story pitch, guys, that we find out they attempted to do this sort of experiment on dead Jedi. Because after all, where are the midichlorians? The midichlorians are in them. So maybe we can extract from a dead Jedi, and you find out, nope, no dice, can't do it. And as a result, like, that gives a little more shading to it, because you have all of these, you know, Jedi you're hunting down and killing. Did they try to take their cells and mess around with them?
Sure. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things too that just on this whole idea of Project Necromancer, one of the things that I think I pieced together that was really interesting was the fact that, you know, we know that Emery and Omega are sisters, and I get the feeling that that Emery is possibly just a failed experiment in what they were trying to create with Omega, because she says, you know, I was at another location, and then, you know, Dr. Hemlock found me and brought me under his wing. And so you get this idea that, you know, she was kind of discarded in some ways because the Kaminoans didn't need her. She didn't achieve what they wanted. And therefore, somebody else picks her up and utilizes her for their benefit. And so I thought that was really fascinating. And it's another thing where I almost wish that there had been a little bit more on, because, I feel like as much as we learn about Omega and her connection to Project Necromancer, I do feel like there's 1,000 other questions about her and all of this that I would have loved to have just had a little bit more on, mainly because, you know, I just find it to be so utterly fascinating. And, this, you know, just her creation, who she is, all of that stuff. So,
yeah, but let me offer this one counterpoint, is that I enjoy a little bit of mystery left.
Sure.
I'm not saying that makes me better or worse, blah, blah, blah. I'm not anything like that. I'm saying
right.
that the one box that this season, this show, manages to avoid are the fan arguments about the explanations. Every time Star Wars has tried to explain something very clearly, it causes this hideous fracture in the fan base, especially in online discourse. If they'd come out and mm-hmm. bluntly said something about yeah. what made That's Omega true. So That's so much point. More special, yep. we'd have never heard the end of it. We'd still be hearing about it. And then in 25 years, people would still be complaining about what they had a problem. Like, it's just like, so I'm actually kind of happy that they were like, I know Omega's special. I know that she has something to do with the way her cells can accept midichlorians in experiments, or the way hers can transmit. Like, you know, she's the key. She's Omega. She's the end of it all. And leaving her future open actually leaves me more hopeful that we'll get another Omega series at some point, or get her in a series at some point. I'd love to see her show up in live action in the Ahsoka era. That would be fascinating to me. But you know, all that being said, you know, I think that what we really need to not let go of is the fact that her empathy is really what makes her incredibly special, like you were saying with Batcher and with Crosshair, because Crosshair is the ultimate pessimist. Batcher is basically a hunting dog. And Omega gets through to both of them and melts their hearts. And they both love her. And it's like that thing, while we can sit there and we can go back and forth about M counts and what makes her genetics so special and all of that type of stuff, what actually makes Omega special is her empathy and her love for others and her willingness to sacrifice and be there. Like, those are actually the things that are the most importantly special things about Omega, especially throughout yeah. this season.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, you touched on something that is really important to the season, which is the idea of putting this unlikely pair together. And I think what's beautiful is the way in which she, like the other clones, the time that she spent with them, she slowly changes Crosshair by her actions, by just being her. And in fact, she brings out the best in all of the clones that she gets to know. And that's what's really beautiful, is to watch her play into Crosshair's redemption arc and what he's willing to do for her because of what she was willing to do for him, even when he kind of hated her, you know? And I just found that to be such a beautiful picture of grace. Completely mm-hmm. unmerited favor. And it's really, really beautiful. And I think it's the kind of thing where, you know, the world just needs more of these type of stories and more characters like Omega, and playing against characters like Crosshair. And it made it a really moving season then, you know, to get to the end, to see what he was willing to do then for her. The fact that he's willing to lose, you know, his shooting hand. The fact that he's willing to do whatever it takes to get her back and make sure she's safe. I mean, I know I'm gushing, but it's one of those things, even when I'm thinking about it, you know, this show is always so good at, I think, and the Star Wars animation is always so good at getting you to a place that you get emotional about the characters that you're watching on screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the best part of putting Omega and Crosshair together so much of this season.
Yeah. I don't know what I can add to that, honestly. I mean, we all know Wrecker is my emotional favorite, but Crosshair, you know, I'm going to say something a little weird, but Crosshair, what I think makes him super relatable for any of us who have been through working at a place that gets acquired by someplace else, right? I've you know, I worked at least two places that got bought by someplace else. And you know, you have that whole thing of like, it does turn you cynical, like even more cynical if you were a cynic, to be like, ah, meet the new boss, worse than the old boss, or, you know, everything's changed. And it's like, it's nice to see Crosshair discover a sense of, you know, just a sense of hope. And additionally, a sense of this is the guy where if you go all the way back to the first season, was the most rugged of the entire batch. He was always the one that was going to be like, well, if they're wounded too badly, we got to move on, sort of thing. And instead, he's moved in this season to a character that is willing to sacrifice himself. And like you said, lose his hand, like lose so much just for the sake of her, of love for someone else. And I mean, it's nice to see Crosshair finally become one of the parents for Omega.
Right. Yeah. I think, yeah, I love that you mentioned that too. And it's something that I didn't even have, you know, here on our topics of conversation outline, just so we could try and not miss things because we're talking about an entire season. But, you know, I think that that's also something that is incredibly beautiful about the season as well. You know, this really is a show about space dads. And I think the fact that you have Wrecker and you have Hunter and you have Crosshair, who are these father figures to Omega in different ways, right? Is really beautiful. And the beauty of it, too, is that you take these characters who were legitimately just made for one thing. And it plays back all the way back to that Clone Wars episode, The Deserter, right? Where you mm-hmm. had the clone who deserted because he didn't believe in the war. And then he falls in love and he has kids. And so you see this ability of these characters to do that. And then you have these, I mean, the ultimate warriors, you know, and they find themselves in a position where they can't help themselves but to fall in love with this child who's been put in their care. And then, mm-hmm. like any good father, be willing to do anything and everything it meant to keep that child safe. And I think that that is also a really incredible story because there are too many times on television where fathers are discounted or shown to be kind of like doofuses or whatever. And I think that this show really speaks to the importance of fatherhood into the lives of children. And I think even especially, you know, with the impact that they can have on their daughters. And I found that to be incredibly beautiful in the series.
Oh, for sure. I mean, the thing that I think is also an interesting sort of meta read of the season is, in a lot of ways, I think that the older fan base of Star Wars, we're all at that age where if we're not parents directly, we have younger people in our lives that we interact with, that we're mentoring, or we're, you know, trying to get them going on their own path and everything. And there's this sort of meta read where we can project ourselves onto the batch as parents or parental figures or mentors. But then at the same time, there's a sense to me of Omega as the fans themselves and the batch sort of representing, and stay with me, I know this sounds crazy, but this season, especially when taken in total of all three of the Bad Batch seasons, feels like this love letter to our own childhoods, in the sense that we had as one of the big influences in our lives through pop culture and everything was not just Star Wars, but the Clone Wars. And so there's this sense of like, almost like giving us a pat on the back and saying, hey, we tried our best to do what you expected of us to, you know, show you something to think about, something to care about, something to help bring out something in you that's special and show you what's great about human connection and love and empathy. And I know maybe it's too deep. I don't know. I mean, and the same thing, there's always that school of thought where it's like the artist doesn't even necessarily need to make the specific intent be that, but you can still get to a place with that. And it's, I see this season very much in more of that meta sense of, especially with the way it ends, it's like, hey, we had a great time, didn't we? But, you know, this chapter is over now. Like, this really is the coda to the Clone Wars. And I don't mean just the show. I mean the entire era of Star Wars. It's like, okay, kid, we got there. Now we got to go on and find some new territory and do some different stuff. We've had a great time.
You know? Yeah, I don't think that's too deep at all. In fact, I think that in many ways, you're 100% right. Because, you know, the whole thrust of this show, not only being about dads, but it was just about the clones themselves, the characters that everybody fell in love with and didn't expect to. You know, I don't think anybody came into the Clone Wars series thinking that clones might be some of their favorite characters. You know, whether it was Rex or Wolf or, you know, Hunter or, you know, Wrecker, all these characters, right? All of these clones that we meet throughout the series. And the fact that, you know, Cody, we never really got to know Cody until the Clone Wars because he was barely in episode 3, right? Yeah. And so I think you're right. In many ways, this helps us put to rest a lot of that time period. And, you know, it's obvious that they could revisit it as they, and we'll talk about soon, Tales of the Empire, where we see some stories that have pieces of that. But, or, you know, they did it in Tales of the Jedi too. So I think your read is actually spot on in that way. And I think that that's one of the things that makes, you know, as we'll talk about later, the coda work. And so I did want to ask you, because one of the fun parts about this series is the way that we return to things. You know, we not only return to things from the first and second seasons of the series, but we do from the Clone Wars, right? You know, and we have characters too as well. So, you know, we go back to Barton 4, where Crosshair made that decision to shoot the Imperial officer, to make the switch where he's finally been broken enough to realize the Empire is not the way to go. You know, we return to Teth. That's one of Rex's bases. We see...
I was so happy to see Teth again, man.
Right?
I mean,
yes.
On. That was so awesome.
And, you know, we get characters back like, you know, Fennec Shand comes back. We have Cad Bane come back, you know, so... I think one of the things that I really loved about this season, and I think I just love about the Bad Batch series as a whole, is they just weren't afraid to utilize all of the material that has been there throughout the Clone Wars, and to, when it's the right thing to do, to use it. Like, I mean, going back to Barton 4 and having... Crosshair be at the place where he made the turn, and that be the place where he earns back his crew's trust, was huge. You know, I mean, also we got, you know, Star Wars space worms. So, you know, who knew that ice worms were the thing? Not sand worms, ice worms.
Hey, you know, all things work. I you know. Yeah, again, the going back to, and you and I hit on this plenty, I think, in all of our discussions over time, you know, when you look at it as a total, but you're right. This is a saga. This is a big saga. And you know that you're in good hands when the people telling the stories don't feel the compulsion to say, oh, well, we've already done that, so we're going to walk away. It's like, no, you're here in the toy box. Use some of these toys. You'll add toys. You'll get new toys, but it's okay. You don't throw out all of your old toys when you get a new toy. If we did, I wouldn't have half the things on my bookshelf right now.
Right.
But like, you know, it is. It is one of those things, though, where it's like, you know, and honestly, to keep the metaphor going, like, some of those old toys are some of your favorite toys. It doesn't matter how new and shiny the thing is.
Exactly.
And so even if the newer toy that comes in a toy box isn't your favorite, you're like, yeah, but if I pair him up with Boba Fett, it works better. And that's okay. And it's a way to start accepting
right.
that new stuff into the box yeah. is, you know, to get it to mix with the things that you already loved.
Well, and I, you know, we've talked about this on Aggressive Negotiations in some ways ad nauseum, but the way in which, you know, by doing these things, by returning to these places, by having these characters show back up, you know, what the animated series are becoming to Star Wars is the thing that helps bind the saga together and and make it more cohesive. I mean, we talked at length here about Project Necromancer, right? And that's a huge part, obviously, of the, you know, part nine of the saga. It's not a thing we all loved, right? And yet, what they're doing through these animated series, by bringing up these stories and making it feel more cohesive, is ameliorating some of those frustrations that we've had with specifically the sequel trilogy, right? But it's making also what's happening in these shows incredibly interesting too. You know, it's not just about trying to get things to connect, you know, it's done in a way to which I almost don't even care if it connects. It does. It's brilliant. It's wonderful. But what it's doing for the story here is, I think, what makes things so special. And so when we get to go back to a place like Barton Four, we get to go back to Teth. You know, we have these characters come back, and we're, like you said, we're playing in the toy box. You know, in some ways, I remember our first episode with Nick Anastasio, and I believe the episode in the 602 Club is called Boys Playing with Toys. And that's kind of what these animated shows, and you were alluding to, feel like, right? It is creators just playing with the toy box of Star Wars in a way that feels authentic to the series, so it fits. And that's what we love about this stuff.
That is what we love about this stuff. And it, I think it also just, it makes it work so much better as well when characters, when you have a Rex come in, in a way, it's almost like, you know, when you're learning your way around a town or something, you get these reference points, and it's nice to have the reference points. It's nice to have Rex. It's nice, even though it seemed to be a little bit controversial, to have Ventress show up. Because, okay, she looks different and her saber's different. So if I didn't read Dark Disciple, this is just, oh, Ventress made it through. If I did read Dark Disciple, I'm saying to everybody, now hold on a minute here. That's weird. I need a little more, but it's still a touch base. It's like, okay, this is in relation to this character being here. And even within the series, having Rampart come back, that was such an unexpected treat for me. I never expected to see Rampart again. And to have him come back and have him be this still a jackass while being a little bit of comic relief, necessary comic relief in a very heavy arc, I really liked it. Like, I actually laughed out loud with him when they were talking about, you know, ditching him or whatever. And you just hear him from off screen go, I can hear you. Like,
yeah, that was great.
There's just,
yes, 100%.
That's one of those great moments where it's like, oh, that's just so organic. That feels right.
Yep.
And I never expected to see him again. And I was happy to see him again.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, But it's just one of those things where, with Ventress, I'm curious to you because I saw her appearance serving a very massively important role in the season without even saying it outright. But her appearance pre-explains how the, just go ahead and call him Super Clone, shows up in another badass ship design, is able to sneak in. Ventress establishes how it's possible to sneak on to Pabu without anybody knowing.
Mm-hmm.
They don't draw attention to it. And then,
right.
But we know when we see the other, you know, when we see the threat show up, it's like, oh, right. Nobody knows about that place. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, you'd think maybe you'd have boarded it up after Ventress showed up, but hey, that's just me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I think the beauty of this was, especially with Ventress returning, what I really appreciate is that they did come out and say, we are not here to contradict what was done in Dark Disciple, specifically, you know, the way that they have with other books. Like, you know, they have contradicted the Ahsoka book and some other things. You know, they've also contradicted the Kanan comics that had come out, things like that. But they specifically said, we plan somewhere else to tell the story. It's going to come. You just need to be patient. But for here, this was not the place to do that, right?
Correct. Yeah.
And that's, I think, where in some ways Star Wars is therefore then taking a page from the comics of this character shows up in this comic, but the way and why they're showing up in the sense of like, I thought they were there. And, you know, that's not that story to tell. You know, and so understanding what story you're trying to tell and not getting caught in, oh, we've got to explain everything, as we kind of talked about earlier. Sometimes it's better not to. But I appreciate that they just kind of head on said, hey, we know all the fans. We know you're freaking out. And look, we know how she returned and why and how all that goes down. This just wasn't the place to tell that story. But it was the place to utilize her here, which, again, when you think back to who she was in the Clone Wars, right? She had become kind of this Ronin. And I think that's fascinating that in some ways she's still kind of playing that role after what happened in Dark Disciple, which is incredibly interesting. And I do think makes for a place where, I mean, I don't know about you, but I find myself on the edge of my seat, proverbially, waiting for the story of what happened and, you know, how she is able to survive.
Yes. And as a final note on Ventress, I will say that it shows again the wisdom of the people who created this series, because the lazy choice would be Obi-Wan showing up to give an explanation, or somehow somebody knows Yoda or Ahsoka showing up. Any of those are expected at this point. Ventress showing up brings Ventress back in, shows the way, that basically opens up that there's still all of these Force users out there. It's just not as many. It's not as welcome. And they go to ground because they know that the Emperor will either capture and kill or torture and pervert them. And so that's why they're very difficult to find, and why it seems like they're extinct is because they know the minute they stick their toe out, they're toast. But having Ventress show up really does open up the universe in the sense that it says definitively, there's more than just a few Jedi that made it past. They're out there, and she's one of them. And so, you know, the storytelling possibilities from that are actually magnified.
Yeah. Well, and the beauty of that, too, you know, we just, and we'll talk about it very soon here, Tales of the Empire, with the idea of the Inquisitors. That's why they were needed, right? Is there were enough Jedi that survive. And that's their job, is to help Vader hunt down these Jedi. And so, you know, again, having Ventress return was great. I think, too, there was a genius of having Rampart return, because he was such a major part of those first two seasons. And so, you know, to have him come back and be the character who, you know, thinks he can utilize this for his benefit, and be the person who in some ways represents the character who is completely unable to change, right? He has every opportunity to be able to change. In fact, Crosshair keeps telling him he should, because the Empire doesn't care about him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll kill him at a moment's notice. And so he will never truly be free if he's trying to get his way back into the good graces of the Empire. And yet he's just a character who just can't accept it. And so having him return like Ventress, I just thought was in some ways almost like the chef's kiss of the season, where we're really mm-hmm. doing things that just, once you see it, you're like, oh, that makes so much sense. And I wouldn't have wanted it to be any other way. And one thing, though, I do have to ask you, John. Moment of silence. For the Marauder that we lost.
Not fair. Not fair.
It's not fair.
Not fair. Don't do this to me, man. This is not cool. Okay.
It's not. I was like, are you kidding me? We did it to the Razor Crest, and now we're doing it to the Marauder?
This hurt worse than Razor Crest.
It
Razor
did.
Crest was just it a did. Nifty looking ship that I liked because it was tied to the Mandalorian. This, I truly loved the Marauder's design, the fact that it looked like a Kamino and Saber dart, the fact that it was our home
such
for
a
these
great
three
call,
seasons.
John. I never thought of that. All oh of my these, gosh, you're I, right.
I wish I could take sole credit. I think somebody else pointed it out to me and I saw it and I was like, oh my gosh, you're right. But the simple fact that I truly loved that ship and that ship me design too. And everything, and they took it from me, Matt. They took her from me. In all honesty, it was like it was as if, now I'm not going to go crazy and be like, oh, they blew up the Millennium Falcon, because that would be I'm rioting in the streets for weeks after that happened.
Exactly.
But this would have been like watching you know, honestly, it's like watching like Luke's X-Wing get blown apart or something like that, where it's like, what? No, what the? You can't do, no, bad.
Are you serious?
Right, yeah. Oh,
so my wife and I were watching the episodes together as we're watching through the season. And when they blew up the Marauder, there was an audible gasp and something along the lines of, oh no, no, not the Marauder.
Yep.
Like, that was my reaction. And, you know, I think what's really actually kind of beautiful about it is the way in which, you know, they weren't going to kill. And they've talked about, I've seen the some interviews with the showrunner and everything here for the Bad Batch, and them talking about, you know, they weren't going to kill another character. But I think that the beauty of these ships, especially a ship like the Marauder, you can lose that ship and it really does create the feeling that you need to have of losing a crew member.
Oh yeah.
And
sure.
The stakes, right? And you know, again, I give them full credit for, you know, being willing to do that. And it in some ways too, it almost makes sense, because where these characters are going to go by the end of the season is they're gonna choose to let go of this life. And losing the Marauder is a way, and it's a stepping stone to that. Because what matters at this point is Omega. And mm-hmm. so, You know, I just love that. God, we got to talk about the finale, man, because, I mean, we get Zillow Beast action. We get a bunch of CX clones, zombie clones going after our normie clones and the Bad Batch. You know, we get Hemlock dying, Nala Se protecting the Kaminoan legacy by destroying research. We get money going to Project Stardust. I mean, this finale is jam-packed full of goodness.
All the way down to, I almost feel like, you know, working backwards, but all the way down to the fact that when Tarkin shows up, it's two Venators and then like a straight-on Star Destroyer, just showing that little, another little nudge that the fleet's changing a little more again.
And, yeah, because he got the best, you know? Yeah. Like, he's
fresh
the top
off the
dog.
Line, man. Yeah. Fresh off the line. But
it's got that new ship smell.
But the fact that they show up, there's all of this devastation. There's a Zillow Beast loose now. There's basically the Zillow Beast turns this planet into Vine World. What are you going to do? Somebody's going to be flying along someday. They're like, oh, look, this is a nice little planet. Let me set to, oh, dear. Oh, my gosh. What is that thing? Right. But there is, I think, this beauty to everything as well, because we know that Hemlock even admits that the Kaminoans knew the secret. The Kaminoans, in a large sense, are like the Darth Plagueis of science in this. And Hemlock is the Palpatine. Where they're chasing after this thing that the true master of the art figured out, and they're chasing it, and they're greedy for it, and they're taking shortcuts, and they're not patient enough. And much like Plagueis dying before all of the secrets got to Palpatine, Nala Se makes sure that basically, if she's going to go out, everything's going with her. And this is the end of any of your hopes of pulling off Project Necromancer anytime between now and 5 years from now, right? It builds in, again, the idea of why does it take so long for Palpatine even to get close to cloning himself? Well, guess what? That's why. Because it goes up here, and Tarkin, as much as we love him as a villain, we come back to this whole idea of he's also a self-serving bureaucrat. Oh, look at all of this destruction. There's a Zillow Beast out. All right, decommission the place and send all of his funding to my project. And it's like, ah, like there's not even a curiosity. There's no desire to carry the work on. There's nothing. And in a sense, that's like, again, it shows where Palpatine's miscalculation with these people that he uses against each other screws him up again. He needed another Hemlock to be like, no. We have to continue the work. We will pick up where we left off. We have some backed up data records, and I know what I was thinking and all of those sorts of things. Hemlock's death and the loss of the research is a massive death blow. And, I was glad to see it, but the I loved the minute that Omega was trying to find out how to sneak out of the place, and she saw the Zillow Beast. My reaction was like, "Oh, you're going to, aren't you? Okay, all right, I'm here for this." Like I was like, "I know what's coming next. There's no way you show me a Zillow Beast and you don't check off Zillow Beast. There you go."
Well, no, I could not agree with you more. I think the beauty of the way in which this whole season really shows off the hubris of the Empire already and the cracks that are forming. Like you said, the fact that Tarkin is a self-serving bureaucrat, you know, that's the thing about Hemlock as a villain, right? And him being destroyed here. He's one of the few people, I think, who truly bought in some ways to what Palpatine wanted to do in a way that Palpatine needed desperately. And he doesn't have that beyond here, you know, and we don't know where the connection to, the strange Sith planet in episode 9 comes in and how Exegol. All that works. Exegol. And so, but it also makes sense as to why, like you said, all of this ends up taking too long, because somebody like Tarkin could care less. Like, he just cares about raw power. He's not into the old religion, you know? Mm-hmm. He doesn't have that old time religion.
Right.
And so because he could care less. And so I love that. And I think too, the finale has Emery finally making the choice, you know, and helping to save the children and taking them away. And then her desire then to help Echo with the clones, you know, as they try to save as many as they can, which, gosh, I want that story. You know, I think that would make mm-hmm. an incredible story to see her go on and do that. And, you know, all of the, and again, I think the beauty of watching Nala Se, who truly was, seemed to be a scientist of the highest caliber, who had incredible knowledge, right, and realized that her knowledge could destroy the galaxy, and then was willing to not pursue that knowledge, but try and keep it from doing that, was awesome. You know, I mean, again, I think there's a lot of kind of Jurassic Park in there, you know, that type of understanding of, you know, what we can do with science. Sometimes it's not worth creating. Sometimes it's not worth doing because the what it can do could lead to ultimate destruction, you know? And so I love that. And then the epilogue was just so epically perfect to me. To have had these space dads raise their daughter in safety, and so that she then has the ability to make her own choices. She has the freedom to make her own choices and then allow their daughter to make that choice was just so beautiful. I could not have been happier with the way that the epilogue worked in this episode.
Tremendous is the only word. That's the smallest word I could give to that epilogue, because it was the whole point. That was the whole point. And just seeing Hunter, and I'm glad the choice was to have it just be Hunter there, because he's the, you know, he's the chief dad, basically. But to have him,
dad.
You know,
I love that.
To have him be there and convey it to her. And it's, you know, I'm of an age, I'm of a stage where soon I'll be facing that same sort of moment. I'm not so big as to deny that was a pretty emotionally resonant scene, because I know it's coming. And it's like the idea that after everything they did, she's going to go run off and join the rebellion to be a pilot, and the risk that's inherent in that. And they have no choice but to say, okay, right? She can't stay there forever. And I'll go ahead and say, it's interesting because Uncle Owen does everything he can to keep Luke on Tatooine. And these dads say, hey, you know, we can't live life for you anymore. You have to live life for yourself. And we did everything we could to make you ready for it. Like, that's a heavy thing, man. That's a big, big moment. And it frustrates me that the only place in Star Wars right now at this moment where I'm getting those types of moments, truly getting them, is in animation. And that's not to take anything away from the emotionally resonant moments in Ahsoka. Ahsoka gets there at a couple of points, but this one was like just an absolute gut punch. Because again, I think it even ties back into that larger like meta read of the series where it's like, it's, you know what it is? I'm going to pay this the highest compliment I can. This cave discussion was the equivalent of Hawkeye at the end of MASH going up after he's given BJ Honeycutt a whole time of saying, why can't you say goodbye, right? And the helicopter pulls away. You see that his friend of all of these years wrote out goodbye in the stones on the helicopter pad. That was this, and this was that, where it was like, it was that moment where you suddenly realize, oh my gosh, yeah, goodbye, you know? Yeah. And it's like, yeah. I got to let you go now. Oh, mm-hmm. So heavy, man.
No, I think that's an incredible pull. And I love that you, too, with these two characters, you let Dee Bradley Baker and you let Michelle Ong play this older version of the characters and to really give them in some ways that kind of resolution, right? That you know that they've been safe for so long. You know that they've been happy for so long. You know that, and the beauty of this too, we don't answer the question, right? We don't know when she goes to join the rebellion, which is great. We don't know what the time period is, you know? It could be kind of anywhere. It could be during Rebels. It could be during some point of Andor. It could be sometime after episode 4 or 5. I mean, who knows, mm-hmm. right? That's the beauty. And so they can use this character then wherever they want because they didn't put a time period on it. They didn't put a time stamp that they're stuck with. And so I think that that's incredibly smart of them. But beyond all that, what it does is it just makes this so moving for these two characters. And, you know, I loved it and I was very, very choked up about it. As we, watched this episode and this finale, my wife and I. And so, John, there's one last thing I feel like we have to talk about, and that's because I think that Kevin Kiner and his family, who have been working on these soundtracks now, it's not just him anymore, but it's also members of his family. Goodness, are they knocking it out of the park in this series?
Mm-hmm. Yes, they are. They're absolutely killing it. And, what I also love most is that the Kiners exist in the space that John Williams did, especially with the original trilogy, where if you knew the music that was being referenced, everybody knows Mars, the Bringer of War, or you know, like there's a lot of Holst's The Planets in the 1977 original, if you listen for it, and you can hear certain martial cues in the Imperial March that you've heard, you know, here or there, but like this is the same sort of thing where whatever temp tracks they were using, the Kiners find a way to nail it without being repetitive or ripping off, but get that same vibe where I'm like, you know, this sounds like something I would have heard from Hans Zimmer. Or this sounds like something I would have heard from James Horner. Or this sounds like something I would have heard in Indiana Jones movies. You know, like, it's good for sounds like that. I'm actually paying a huge compliment here because I don't look at it and say, oh, you just stole that from. I look at it and I say, I know exactly what you're trying to tell me emotionally right now. And that's exactly the right spot for that music to exist, while at the same time creating its own identity so that I have themes within that framework that work perfectly well. I'm a huge, huge fan of their work. I suspect, of course, you are too. Was there any episode that like really jumped out at you as like the best music episode?
Wow, that's a really good question. I think honestly, one of the episodes that really jumped out was the very first episode of the season, you know, just the hauntingness of that as we kind of follow Omega's new routine and her being there for so long. I enjoyed the episode where we're back on Teth and the references to the Clone Wars film. And I really liked the episode. I think the one that really I loved the most maybe was the Ventress episode and the cues that we got in that. I thought they were gorgeous. But I've enjoyed listening to the sound. I mean, in one, the soundtracks they're releasing are like, I think there's over 2 or more hours worth of music between the two albums. It's incredible. I misspoke. There's over 4 hours and 27 minutes of music beyond with the two albums combined. And so just wonderful. I mean, you know, Kiner and his family truly seem to understand Star Wars, and they're doing a great job. They did the same thing with the Ahsoka series, and this is just beautiful. So all in all, you know, I couldn't say enough about what they're doing. But John, I think I know the answer to this, but if you did have to rate the season 3 of The Bad Batch, the final season, what would you rate this series?
Solid 5. I mean, without even a thought.
Yeah.
It's
so good.
Simply sticking the landing like this, that last 6-episode stretch, right?
Yes.
In and of itself.
Yes.
That's like,
I did not even mention, but one of the things I loved about that is it felt so reminiscent of the end of Deep Space Nine, where every single episode, those last 6 episodes, they just connect.
Yeah, Deep Space Nine, like once you hit like Siege of AR-553, right? Or was it 553?
It's 551, I think. Anyway, yeah, I know.
That episode, once you hit that episode, like you had locked in and they were like, okay, guys, this is it. And yeah, same vibe here where it's like, I mean, but that's also, you know, honestly, as much as I would have wanted even more seasons of The Bad Batch, I think that look at what happened as well with the 4th season of Rebels. Once a creative team knows they've got just this amount of time left, I think it really, though it may be painful, really the great creators step forward and say, okay, challenge accepted. We're going to do this and we're going to do it our way. And they did it their way. And boy, did they do it. So yeah, sorry to ramble, but yes, 5 stars.
No, you're not rambling at all. I think 100%. They just did such a great job with that finale. And that finale, like you said, really is those 6 episodes all together. In many ways, I would almost love to see a master cut of that where it's all put together and I can just watch it all without having any breaks, you know, because I think it would be so much fun to be able to do that.
When they release the 4K discs, maybe they could do that for us.
Well, you know, I do hope, and this is something, you know, they've been doing the series now. You know, we've got The Mandalorian season 1 and 2. We've got Andor out season 1. We've got Kenobi coming out. It isn't out now. We should get the entire series of The Bad Batch in a box set. We should be getting, they need to do, I think, a full release of the Clone Wars, and if there's any way to put those in 4K, please do that as well. You know, I have the seasons, but I will buy them again. And you know, I think, I guess. Okay, one last question, if that's okay.
Please.
Where do we go next with Star Wars Animation? Obviously, I know we had Tales of the Empire. We're going to talk about that here soon, but. If you are in charge of Disney, Star Wars, Disney Animation, Lucasfilm Animation, what are you doing?
I'm finding Omega during the original trilogy in the Rebellion. I've said there are other show ideas I've had where I'm like, oh, I'd love to go off with Ventress, or I'd love to find out about the Clone Rebellion and actually stay with them. I'm totally down with that too. But if I were an exec and somebody came in and they said, we're going to pick up Omega, and it's going to be a totally different cast of characters aside from her, and she says she's going to go off to be a pilot for the Rebellion, I want to go put her sometime around Return of the Jedi, honestly. I would tie it in that way. I want to go in. I want to find Omega sometime around Return of the Jedi. And the ending of the series then, it could either be right after the final battle of Endor and her going around and helping, sort of like almost an Alpha Squadron sort of vibe, or have her going and, you know, just being the fleet they meet up at Sullust, right? We get the story of what was going on while everybody was in Hoth and scattered at Bespin and stuff like that. What about you?
Oh my goodness. I think your idea is phenomenal.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm not just saying that. Like, I had thought about this idea of like following Omega, but the idea of kind of putting her in that time period, I think, is really interesting, especially because of the way I think that could help you lead into the post Return of the Jedi era, which, you know, Mandalorian doesn't pick up till 6 years later. And it almost feels as though that show could bridge the gaps, right, between Empire and then, you know, through episode 6 and, you know, into then that new era. So I love it. I think it would be really, really cool to see that. And you could add a lot of different characters there, you know, whether it's a Hera and characters like that and stuff. So you have so much that you could do there. So I think that's great. I love it. Well, John, it's always fun getting to talk Star Wars. In fact, spoiler alert, we're going to be doing it next week too. So you're welcome.
Yes, we are. Yes.
There's going to be more Star Wars talk coming your way. But if people want to catch up with you and see what else you've got going on beyond Star Wars talk, as if there is anything else, where
Not
can they
much.
Find you?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. But you can also find me being a little scamp over on the Nerd Party Network, or here on the Nerd Party Network, because this is a crossover episode. So I'm on the Nerd Party Network while I'm talking about this too, as well as on TFM. So aside from the great time that I have coming on and being in the 602 Club and causing mayhem here on TFM, I'm regularly on the Nerd Party Network, co-hosting two shows, one of them called House Lights and one of them called Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast, which, of course, like you said, I co-host with you, Mr. Matthew Rushing.
I love that we're in the place where Aggressive Negotiations began in the 602 Club. It just feels right to be here and having us cross over. We're going to do it again very soon for you all, as we mentioned. Of course, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02. I'm on the Nerd Party Network with a completed show called Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series. And on the TFM Network as well, you can find me doing a bunch of different shows about Star Trek series, such as Enterprise or Strange New Worlds, Picard, and Deep Space Nine. But as always, you know, thank you so much for joining us. And John, I think it's time to head back to the temple, because they've got a special on Blue Milk tonight with that Admiral Akbar cereal with real seed food bits. So let's go.
You know what, Matt? I think it's time to close these negotiations and maybe have some Boba Fett tea here at the 602 Club. ¶¶